afternoon. This is Resonance 104.4 FM, and you're listening to Little Atoms with Richard Sanderson and me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about science, rationalism, atheism, and the left. Our guest on today's show is the mentalist and skeptic Philippa Scoffey, aka the Grey Man, and Richard's now going to introduce us to Philip.
Thanks, Neil. Philippa Scoffey, or to give him his more enigmatic working name, the Grey Man, has been working as a psychic illusionist and mind reader for the last 8 years. This involves working on a one-to-one level with members of the public. His website says, what he does is live, interactive and intimate, and with no stage or TV screen to behind which to hang explanations, it will challenge what your guests believe they thought possible in a way that no magician can. One person who witnessed a Grey Man performance said, if someone asked me what's the most inexplicable thing that I've ever seen, I would now be able to answer them. He's recently been seen on television as an expert consultant on Channel 5's Britain's Psychic Challenge. Philip, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks very much, Richard. Hi.
I think perhaps the most interesting description of what you do is psychic illusionist. Does this mean that you're not a psychic, but perhaps something more complicated, like you create the illusion of being a psychic? And if that's so, was that a very deliberate distinction that you wanted to make?
Yeah, obviously my role as the Grey Man and my role sat here are almost diametrically opposite. Mm-hmm. When I'm working as the Grey Man, I don't make any claims as to how I'm doing what I do. We've got some very successful psychic entertainers, some on telly at the moment. Some of them claim psychic ability, some of them claim psychological understanding. The Grey Man doesn't make any claims. He does what he does, and it's up to the viewer on any particular occasion to decide what they want to believe. And inevitably, some will go away thinking I'm a con man, some will think I'm psychic, some will think I'm psychologically very clever. But the Grey Man himself makes no specific claim. I just feel that people are much more likely to find a belief system that fits for them if I leave it neutral enough for them to be able to apply whatever makes them feel most comfortable.
Indeed, the Grey Man seems a deliberately anonymous creation.
Absolutely.
Of yours.
Absolutely.
So if I was in a room and the Grey Man had been hired or was doing a performance, mm-hmm. what sort of things would we be expecting? Are we going to see card tricks or...
No, not really. In my world of mind reading and mentalism, there is a big debate as to whether a mind reader or mentalist can use cards in their performance because it screams magic trick. That's, other than playing solitaire on the computer, our interaction with cards tends to be watching magicians make them appear.
Yes,
and
pick
disappear.
A card is
absolutely
very much a cliche, isn't
yeah.
it?
And it doesn't matter, really, in my view, what you do with a card trick. It is a dull card trick, and the mm-hmm. majority of lay people... And I think there's probably a sexist divide there. Most... particularly females, are not hugely interested in card tricks. Back in the 50s, there was a great mind reader called Chan Canasta, and he did use cards, and I think very successfully. But I think it takes an inordinate amount of skill to sell yourself as a mind reader and to use cards and not be confused with a magician. I think Canasta got away with it. I don't know if my skill levels are quite there yet. If I do something with a playing card, it will be you just thinking of a playing card and me telling you what you're thinking.
Right.
And there we just use cards because there's 52 of them and everyone knows them. And they're...
So you're actually working pretty propless.
Yes.
You are this anonymous, the Grey Man,
yeah.
and you come in and work purely with people.
Yeah. I mean, as speaking as the Grey Man, I don't need props, do I? If I'm reading your mind, I'm reading your mind. When you're working on a stage, inevitably to make it more accessible to 200 or 300 people, you need to start writing things big and compromising slightly on this lack of props. But in an ideal world, as the Grey Man, I'm trying to create the illusion that I'm invading your thoughts.
So can you take us back and tell us how you actually got started in how the Grey Man came to be?
Well, I wasn't hugged enough as a child. No, I got a box of tricks when I was about 6, as I think probably most of us in this room did. Mm-hmm. The innate show-off in me probably meant I stuck with it longer than most of us did. And I think it intrigued me on a level of this is a very easy way to make people listen to me and go, gosh, you're very clever. That shine has perhaps worn off. What interests me much more now is even when I'm working as the Grey Man, if I step out of that just watching how people process what they're experiencing, because it gives me an insight into how people think and why they want to believe in certain things and why they don't. So even when I'm working as the grey man who doesn't make any claims or non-claims, I think there's a bit of Philip Escoffi still sort of watching how sceptical John the businessman, who's very atheistic in his approach to life, suddenly is asking me if I want to work for him. What's happened in his head? Why has he abandoned all that very logical sound thinking? Because I've told him the name of the first girl he ever kissed. Are people that, is the tipping point that close to the surface? And that intrigues me. If you can find the need in someone, be it someone who's terminally ill to go to a more serious end, or someone who's desperate to make it in the music industry, doesn't matter how intelligent they are, if I come along offering the panacea to that, you've got a con on your hands, you've got a potential deal.
Yeah. So, although obviously we're on radio, we've just been talking about the possibility of you demonstrating a couple of these, a couple of these mining reading tricks. So, is there anything you could actually do to show us that we could get across to the listeners without?
Yeah, obviously radio is a slightly prohibitive medium, and it requires your listeners to trust that you're not in collusion with me in any way. But I mean, we mentioned the idea of you thinking of a playing card. If I got you to pick a card, as I say, it's a dull card trick, and it doesn't matter if I find it or not. Any enthusiasm you show, I would suggest, is politeness. If one of you were to think of a playing card and I told you which one it was, this perhaps is a little more intriguing. So argue amongst yourselves who wants to do that, Richard.
Okay, I'll think of one. I've thought of one.
Okay. There is an argument that perhaps I rely on the fact that certain cards get picked more often than others, and that there's a truth to that. They're what we call population stereotypes. Mm-hmm. If I ask your listeners to think of a vegetable, there's a chance that 70 to 80% of them will be thinking of a carrot. If you ask them to name a letter, the chances are it's T or A. Mm-hmm. So we know these things, and I would suggest all self-respecting mediums and psychics know these things as well. So do you want me to tell you what the three or four most chosen playing cards are, or are you happy to go on your own? Some people worry I might be trying to influence them.
No, I'm happy.
I'll tell you afterwards what those four are.
Yeah, I'm happy with my choice. At the moment.
I have no idea what you're thinking at this point, Richard. That would be demonic. So I'm going to ask you four questions. Your job is to make my life as difficult as possible.
Okay.
So by that I mean you could lie or not answer at all or answer in Swahili. Do what you like.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to ask, Richard, is your card a club?
No.
You can say no every time. That's fine. Is your card a heart?
Yes.
Is your card a diamond?
Yes.
Is your card a spade?
No.
No. Right. I'm sensing you were lying at least once. if you look at the back of your card in your imagination, what colour is the design on the back of the card that you're thinking of?
Grey.
No guessing why you might have said that. now the value of your card. Would you name an animal?
An elephant.
An elephant. Are you aware of the grey elephant from Denmark gag? No.
No.
Okay. I'm going to turn over one card in here, Richard. The one I've got a pack of cards here now. I'm going to turn over one in the pack, and I'll show you this in a moment. Don't tell Neil just yet what your card is. Do chat amongst yourselves.
Yeah, Philip is just getting a card out of a pack of cards.
Just turning one over. That's done. And I will show you that in a moment. If it's wrong, obviously it'll be slightly awkward, and I'll leave, and we never met. So you can't change your mind now, Richard, and so everyone's involved. For the first time, what card were you thinking of?
I was thinking of the Four of Hearts.
Four of Hearts. And this relies on you guys being the eyes for all the listeners. But if I go through this pack, you should see somewhere in here one of the cards has been turned over.
It is the Four of Hearts.
And it's the one you were thinking of. Now, on this occasion, I got you right, which is nice. Mm. But it's a 1 in 52 chance. Let's not renounce religion just yet.
Well, I'm absolutely astounded, because I really did think that was not going to be an obvious card.
Did you think of another card beforehand? And if so, did you think of the Seven of Spades?
No, I did think of something like the Ace of Clubs first.
Ace.
Like one of the...
So which are the most common?
The four most commonly chosen, I'd say, are the Ace of Spades, the Queen of Hearts, and then amongst men more than women, for various reasons, the two Black Sevens, Seven of Clubs and Seven of Spades. And particularly that you went to the Four of Hearts was something that made me think you might well have gone for the Seven of Spades to begin with, because when we do change our minds, we know that psychologically you tend to change colour and move three away. Moving less, if you initially are thinking of the Ten of Clubs and you think, actually, no, that may be too obvious. You change colour because that feels like you're making a big change to your initially seemingly obvious choice. And then we tend to move two or three away from the original thought. because any more than that feels like a waste of energy to go down to the Two of Hearts, and any less than that feels like you're staying too close to the source of the crime.
I desperately did try to think of, you know, the most anonymous sort of card I could, rather than anything particularly flashy, one that would be singularly unexciting.
But so long as I've worked out how I think you think, then just knowing that, I know not to guess a picture card, I know not to guess an ace, I know not to guess a spade, as a rule, because people see that as a commonly chosen suit. So in your resistance, you're actually complying.
Becoming entirely predictable.
Perhaps, yes. Or maybe I'm just a cheat.
Can we carry on a little bit with the autobiographical stuff? Because we found out the early stuff with the magic tricks that you had. How did you come up with the idea of the grey man? I mean, did you ever go through a period of wearing the pointy hat with stars on and doing all that stuff?
No. I was slightly drawn to the spangle. But I've been on a course and I've worked that through. I don't think you would come into my house and know that I have the background that I do. A lot of my colleagues, I think you walk in and it's a slightly scary shrine to all things shiny and glittery, which is lovely, I'm sure. The evolution to mind reading, very, very briefly, for me nowadays in 2006, a magician can do some incredibly entertaining, artistic, creative things. But in my view, it's incredibly rare, if impossible, for a magician to do something which not only leaves you thinking, I don't know how he did that, but leaves you thinking, and I can't for sure say he wasn't doing it like that. You watch a magician now cut a woman in half. I don't know how he did it, but I can say for sure he didn't cut a woman in half. 100 years ago... when it was first being performed,
they would have been calling the police.
Yeah, women fainted, men perspired. It was, you know, Selbit did it back at the end of the 19th century. And caused huge sort of controversy and excitement. Had he mastered some way of dematerializing human cells? We don't feel like that nowadays. And I think with magic, it's very difficult to achieve that state of, I don't know how he's doing it, and I can't for sure say how he's not doing it. With mind reading done well, I believe you can achieve that. With an intelligent, rational, logical person, they can watch what you do and say, not only do I not know how he's doing that, I can't for sure say he's not doing it like that. I struggled perhaps with you two to get to that point, but a lot of people, you can. Whether I achieve that or not, I don't know. I think Geller certainly achieved that memorably, is the last person to achieve that. Derren Brown, perhaps somebody you're familiar with, does achieve that and doesn't achieve that, in my view. He doesn't achieve it in that he doesn't make as big a claim. He's not asking you to believe that he's psychic. He's asking you to believe that he's psychologically very switched on. So he's asking you to abandon your principles and belief systems on a much lesser level than perhaps somebody claiming psychic ability or mediumistic.
But he is still asking you to take some sort of imaginative leap and believe that he's doing something that actually he isn't.
Because
you brought up Uri Geller, and I think although we obviously talked about
he famously lost, of course, the case against James Randi.
He did.
Yeah.
Although we talked about the cutting the lady in half, the viewers in Victorian times seeing that would have thought perhaps that it was real. Now we don't. Although that doesn't mean that magic, you know, the big magicians have lost anything, because the audience is complicit in the fact that it's fake, but they suspend the disbelief because it's an enjoyable show. And I wonder, because you make no claims whatsoever, Derren Brown makes claims that he's not psychic but something else, whereas Uri Geller will make claims that he's psychic. However, I don't see that as being, you know, we're going to get onto the sort of morality of sort of psychics and whatever a bit later in the show. But I would still suggest that viewers watching Geller are still saying, well, okay, you're saying that, but we still know it's a trick. We still know you're a magician.
Oh, you'd be amazed, though. I'm not sure that if you took 100 people off the street and asked them, is Geller a magician or a psychic, what they would say. I my guess would be 60 to 70% would say, I think he's probably doing something, he's got a gift.
Possibly, but I'm just trying to make the distinction between you going to see Uri Geller perform a show, or him being on a chat show, rather than going to a booth at the seaside, or going to a little, to have a reading or something, you know, which is where you're going to seek something, whereas with Geller you're going to be entertained.
Well, it's my belief, though, that and I have, it's just my belief that Geller does give give readings to people.
Oh, okay.
Whether he does that as part of his show or somebody he meets next on a plane. But Uri Geller, in my view, is a great, great showman. And if there's an opportunity to be had... I mean, when Big Ben stopped, I think I recall Uri coming out and saying, oh, I won't do that again. Well, I'd be slightly more interested if he told us just before Big Ben stopped. But then maybe I'm too demanding.
I'm curious about the appeal of this sort of stuff. I mean, as an audience member... to me, it seems an almost masochistic appeal, and very gently masochistic, but masochistic all the same. Because I think when I see a magician or a mentalist or indeed something like what you've just done in front of me now, which was completely astonishing, I also feel incredibly irritated by it. But it's a kind of nice irritation, which is why I'm describing it as vaguely masochistic. In that I simply cannot grasp how it's being done. Mm. And do you think that is part of the appeal? That people just kind of don't get it?
You're probably better qualified to answer that as the person who's just experienced it. I don't think everyone fits into your camp. We tend to sort of divide people into goats and sheep. Sheep are the ones that... No, don't tell me. I don't want to know. It's magic.
Mm.
And goats are the ones that... You don't tell me I'm going to burn down your village and attach wires to your nipples kind of approach. And I think you probably fit more comfortably into the latter.
Mm.
I've never heard it described as masochistic, but I think, yeah, there probably is something in that. I don't know. I'm always on this side of it.
Yeah.
It's a long time since I saw something that made me feel what perhaps you just felt when you saw your card being chosen. Mm. I don't know. Why do people watch? I think we're always interested in sort of exploring things just at the edge of our sort of remit of understanding and knowledge. So if a man was outside that door, hovering a foot off the ground, it doesn't matter what I'm sitting here chatting, you're going to go out and have a look.
Absolutely.
Because it transcends what you believe exists.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because I remember seeing, and we've mentioned Derren Brown, but I saw something that he did recently on TV, and he did the unexpected thing of explaining how he did the trick. And I felt in two minds when I saw him do that. I mean, part of me did think, oh, well, this seems a bit of a shame to show me. But then there was also, and that was an astonishing thing, because you suddenly realise how fast he had to move in a dark room in this particular trick. I forget exactly what it was he was doing, but he had to move extraordinarily fast. And you suddenly realise there really was a big skill to this. It isn't just a trick in the... You know, in the negative sense of the term.
Yeah, that often, though, the skills that genuinely are being utilised aren't the skills that we're advertising. It's a very frustrating dynamic for magicians and mind readers, because we tend to go out onto a stage and show what we can do at the point where no one can see us doing it.
Mm.
A violinist who's mastered that particularly difficult passage goes on stage at the point where they can show it off to its fullest.
Absolutely.
So there's an incredible frustration, I think, in all magicians, because you want to go out and say, did you just see me get that card from the middle of the pack up to the top, colour it in, put your signature, you know.
Yeah.
But of course, because we're suggesting it's done with magic, we have to be very quiet about that. So...
And in some ways, the more unassuming you are, the better, you know.
I think so. I think there's actually a real problem the second you walk out onto a stage in a black bow tie, and being believed to be a mind reader. For me, a good mind reader comes out and is incredibly uncomfortable with people, isn't very gracious, but does these incredible things, sort of almost socially uncomfortable. That, to me, would be much more credible. And the fact is, whenever one comes over from the East, a Russian mystic girl who can see through people or any of these things, suddenly all our cognitive defences seem to go down. There was a programme a few weeks ago on... BBC Two, I believe, Horizon, about the psychics in Vietnam. And as far as I was concerned, they were applying exactly the same principles and techniques as the psychics in East Cheam. But because they were from Vietnam, it seemed the whole production team became slightly rose-tinted and were seeing it as it was presented, not as I thought it was really happening.
So all their sceptical faculties were...
Absolutely. It seemed. It was incredible. And They're making a point that these two government-approved psychics, because they've got a big problem with all these missing-in-action soldiers not being reunited with their families, and in the Vietnamese culture, this is an incredibly important thing, that you get the remains of your loved ones. So, of course, they sanctioned these psychics, because I think it gets rid of the problem. They've DNA-tested two of the match-ups these psychics have done and said that they were right. Well, I would like to see those results because I believe that they have found a solution to a big problem. Mm-hmm. And I can't argue with that. There is a duplicity in it if I'm right in what I'm saying, but I don't have a better solution. The families are happy, but they were saying that these psychics don't get paid, so we can't be cynical about them. And then half an hour later, pointing out that this enormous house that one of them lives in was a contribution from a very grateful client.
Mm.
But they said that without realising what they were saying. So I think the background against which you do what you do is as important in being convincing as what you're actually doing.
And I think when we're in the second half of the show, I want to, you know, go in depth into this sort of the morality of the grey area between, you know, the different techniques and things. But before we get there, you sort of mentioned it a moment ago, but the psychic in each team, mm-hmm. who's giving readings to little old ladies, is contacting their dead cat or dead husband, yes. or whatever. And yourself, you are using the same techniques to a certain extent. Presumably you're skilled in cold reading, etc. Yes. And so is that always easy for you to spot? I mean, does it become very easy to spot somebody, or they're obviously a fake? I can see what they're doing. I know what they're doing.
I mean, occasionally you come up against something that you really can't explain initially, but then a little bit of groundwork and you mm-hmm. find the solution. I'm led to believe that Doris Stokes, sort of very eminent medium, would do things that were well beyond cold reading. And just to give a bit of background, cold reading is the ability, and people would argue that cold reading is more involved than what I'm about to say, but very briefly, the ability to say things to people that feel incredibly personal to them but are actually much more generalistic.
Sure.
And then you move into things like warm reading and hot reading. Warm reading is when you have a bit of background information on the person, and hot reading is when you have actual facts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Doris Stokes was doing a certain amount of hot reading, if certain research is to be believed. She would get letters after shows saying that we tragically lost our son 3 months ago. He was Tim. We loved him dearly. He was about to get married to Rosie, yada, yada, yada. And could we come and have a private reading, Mrs. Stokes? And her people would respond that she doesn't give private readings, but her next show will be at so-and-so town hall. Mm-hmm. Please find enclosed a couple of complimentary tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And then the green stickers would come out, which got put on the chairs of these people, so that Doris knew, there's the parents of Tim, who died, and would then give this incredibly accurate reading that a sort of sceptic like me would watch and, okay, this is going well beyond the realms of generality. But then, as I say, when you explore a little deeper, you find the solution. I've yet to see anything that I haven't been able to explain.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see something that I can't explain. It would be an exciting day.
Yes, it's almost taken the fun out of it for
you. Absolutely, yeah.
But I think this is also the mistake that the psychic and sort of esoteric practitioners make in saying that skeptics and scientists are just killjoys and they're not interested, whereas the opposite is true. It would be, you know, it would be amazing to find out that there was life after death, and everybody would be happy with that sort of thing. But it's
I think some skeptics have painted themselves into a corner where they would find it very difficult now to come out and say, oh, maybe I was a little sort of premature in my judgment. People whose career has become just as a sceptic, you could level that at me to a certain extent, but I don't think I'm so established that now for me to say I met Madame Zablatska and she was phenomenal, and with all my experience and knowledge, and I have to give credit that she's psychic. I think there are some sceptics out there who'd find that very difficult to do.
Sure.
But, as you say, it's a good point to make. I'm not here to just sort of bang the final nail into the psychic's coffin. Not at all. I just don't want to confuse mirages with truth,
mm-hmm.
which is what we do a lot.
That's a good point, I think, to take a short break of about 4 minutes. And I'm going to use this actually as a plug, because I'm going to be presenting another programme at 7 o'clock tonight in the Clear Spot, and I'm going to be interviewing the composer Daniel Figgis, who I know is bringing a load of his own music to play. One of the ones he won't be playing on the show is this from his album Skipper, and it's a track called Bolted.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM. That was the music of Daniel Figgis, who you'll be able to hear me talking to at 7 o'clock tonight. And that was a track called Bolted from his, I consider, classic album, Skipper. We're sitting, Neil Denny and me, Richard Sanderson, we're sitting in the Resonance studio with the mentalist, in the old-fashioned sense of the term, I should possibly say, Philip Escoffey.
Philip, I want to talk now about the... we've talked about the grey man persona, and I want to get into the sort of sceptic side of psychic ability. And let's talk about the distinction between what you do as a psychic illusionist and a psychic who believes to be genuine or pretends to be genuine. And I want to talk about the sort of where the sort of moral distinction with this lays. And if we can look at it in this way, there's an interesting interview on your website where you talk about this in terms of the concept of free speech or free will, in that a lot of people perhaps think that a psychic is conning somebody. They're going after vulnerable, bereaved people who are a low ebb and are sort of taking money out of them, and perhaps in some way should be banned or regulated or something.
Sure.
You take the opposite tack to this, don't you, really? And if I can sort of describe it as the... A person's freedom to be an idiot in the way of their own choosing, I suppose.
I don't think you're quoting word for word there, but yeah, I take your point.
So, if you'd elaborate on this a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even necessarily sort of planting my stake next to any particular camp, but I'm asking the question that at what point should we intervene?
Indeed.
And I'm not sure if I've got any answers, but I felt in the interest of balance when I did that interview that it is certainly something I feel that, yes, on the one hand, I do find it very difficult. And if it was my mother who was going to contact somebody that she had lost and I knew she was being exploited, I'd exploited, if that's how you see it, I'd find that difficult. But in the same breath, you know, do we extend this? I'm an atheist. I have no religious belief, but I wouldn't want to take away religion from people who do have a belief for two reasons. A, I can't be sure that I'm right, but more importantly, I can't replace that with anything. Mm-hmm. So I go away and strip at their belief systems, and I manage to convince them that the doctrine they follow, the faith they have, is wrong. However, I could do that. One can't, but if I could, what have I actually achieved? I could feel very pious that I've given them I've removed one sort of lens from in front of their eyes, and they're seeing the world in a slightly truer way, but who says that's a good thing? Who decrees what is right and what's wrong? And whatever you say about psychics, I think you would have to apply to them to any faith-based product, and that does include religion. It does include, for me, things like aromatherapy. You know, do we get rid of all of that because there is no hard scientific evidence to suggest that it exists? I don't know the answer. I find it very difficult to watch. Particularly when I think psychics fall into two camps. There are those that know they're fraudulent, and or maybe three camps, the real ones, those that know they're fraudulent and those that genuinely believe in their abilities. And of course,
stick with two.
I find the latter group less offensive, but on one level, slightly more worrying. So I don't know. I don't know. What's your view?
Well, I just wonder where the distinction is between, as the way you've described it, the psychic as being, in terms of like faith groups, somebody who's bereaved can go along and they can get comfort, even if that comfort is false.
Yes.
To them, they're still getting it. But I wonder also whether or not, because the psychic is providing a service, why this is different from things that we do have protection from, like food labelling or medicine labelling, or, you know, if I hire a plumber and he comes around and he doesn't fix my sink but then charges me for it, I would expect some sort of recompense for that.
Yes, but it's much easier to demonstrate that the plumber hasn't fixed your sink.
Indeed.
It's not so easy to demonstrate that Madame Zelda hasn't contacted your dead cat. I think there's a guy called Derek Ogilvie. He's just started a series called... he's a sort of baby psychic.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You know, this is another brilliant area because the baby can never say, I don't think that. You know, animals, babies.
Animals.
It doesn't, you know, so long as the person you're supposedly reading isn't answerable, you're onto a winner. So dead people, animals and babies make excellent subjects. And it's amazing that these babies never grow up remembering their communication with Derek Ogilvie. And I'm sure he's got an answer.
So you were recently, as Richard mentioned in the introduction, involved in Channel 5's Britain's Psychic Challenge. You were one of the...
I'm a psychic, get me out of here.
if I can say it in this way, one of the token sceptics that they like to put on these shows is to provide some sort of scientific balance. How did you get involved in this?
By not realising that they have token sceptics on these programmes to give them scientific balance.
So you did actually go into it thinking that it was going to be sensible.
I did. My seeing powers let me down. I enjoyed it very much, and it was a great experience, but it wasn't what I initially felt I was going into. Mm-hmm. One of my stipulations was that either Richard Wiseman or Chris French be on the panel, because I think I felt that gave it a little more sort of robustness. I was also led to believe initially that I would be more involved in the design of the challenges.
Sure.
And was very disappointed when I found out the person designing the challenges was somebody who ran a psychic school in Norway. Well, that's like asking the poacher to build the fence, isn't it?
I have to confess I didn't actually see the programme. So just for me, what did it consist of?
I watched it all, I'm sad to say.
Neil, so many questions. it was... if you watched it and took it at face value, it was a sort of pop idol for psychics.
Right.
Right. That was the overt tone. And each week, after extensive... The viewers can't see the raised eyebrows when I say that, but after the extensive auditions, they whittled them down to 8 who formed the body of the 7 or 8 weeks of programming. So each week they would be set 3 or 4 challenges at various locations around the country, and one of the 3 skeptics, myself, Chris French, and the slightly less skeptical but lovely Jackie Moulton, mm-hmm. would be in attendance on these tests, but not tests designed by us, tests designed by others, and we would witness these, and then a very edited version of that would be broadcast to great effect.
Was your role, I mean, Neil's described you as the token sceptic on it, but was your role to say, this is how he's doing it? Or I could replicate what he's doing?
No, they didn't want that from me. There's probably people from the production team screaming at their radios, but I and Chris felt increasingly marginalised because they realised that psychic results get good viewing figures and no result gets poor viewing figures amongst most of us. You probably would have tuned in much more had there been no results.
Yeah.
But most people want to see something. And of course they realise that the more input Chris and I had, the less likely they were to achieve psychic results. So we got pretty sort of, I think, silenced along the way.
You were presented, it was often edited, so you'd come on at the end, someone would do something that looked ostensibly quite remarkable, and then you'd be presented saying, oh, well, you know, like a bit killjoy.
Yes,
sort of,
exactly.
You'd like to deflate it.
Absolutely. So, and it was very frustrating because what you got shown would be 40 seconds of 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And during those 2 hours, on some occasions, and I'm really not exaggerating, every illness, date, name and location was mentioned. And in the 40-second edit, it seemed like an incredibly accurate reading. And you can make that look how you want it to look. There are some rumours that the person who won it was being groomed right from the start because they wanted her to have her own show to muscle in on the whole Living TV, Derek Acora, okay. Colin Fry. Mm-hmm. And Diane Lazarus, who won, was an incredibly professional and charming and delightful
with
person.
A superb name for that.
It is incredible, and apparently not changed.
So she was clearly the most professional and looked,
yes,
from
and
the very beginning, the one that was
yes.
going to win it, where my girlfriend and I said that all the way.
And she had a sort of a charm and a personability about her, which made her very likeable. You know, saying I'm the only psychic in the village is going to endear people towards you, and she did what she did very well. She achieved some interesting things. And there was one thing she did that I would be interested in looking at further, but there were so many ways in which it could have been achieved non-psychically that I can't, much that I might want to, say that was psychic, because, you know, it's the scientist who pulls off a spider's leg and says jump, and it doesn't jump, and it jumps, and he pulls off another leg and he says jump, and it jumps, and eventually he pulls off all 8 legs and says jump, and the spider doesn't jump, and he concludes that if you pull all a spider's legs off, it goes deaf. You can reach the wrong conclusions sometimes. And, before we sort of rewrote science as we know it, we'd need to do some more tests with Diane.
Well, I think the interesting thing as well was how it was like the scores were sort of reset at the end of every programme. So somebody would win, somebody would be voted by a panel at the end of each show, they were the best, and somebody would be voted off. But by the end of the series, the person that won had not sort of accumulated, had they? They'd not sort of accumulated. So one week someone would do terrible but would survive. The next week they would win. The next week they would do badly again and be voted off. So it never seemed... So bearing that in mind, if you were setting the tests... Mm. I mean, the other thing that strikes you about these tests was... Not only were they wrong so many times, you think, I don't know, perhaps I'm wrong here, but if I'm psychic, I think I should be able to get it right every single time. I mean, I would have thought
Why do you think that?
Because I'm psychic. It's strange, I can read minds.
Yeah, but you don't believe in psychic ability, but yet you believe you know what a psychic could or couldn't do if they were.
Well, what that,
perhaps
okay,
psychics
perhaps
can
that's...
only sense the colour green behind closed curtains. Maybe that's their only ability. And that, to answer your question, is what I would have done with the tests. I'd have asked the psychics what it is that they claim to be able to
do.
Yes,
because
they got incredibly frustrated. They felt that these finding bodies hidden around the place were very aimed at Diane, because that was her little area of, you know, if these were trump cards, Diane's special powers, finding bodies, 85. Oh, God. You know, that was her thing, whereas, as I used to call him, Austin No Powers, man of misery, he was a lovely guy and got very frustrated because he felt that the tasks weren't particularly aimed at him.
Mm.
So that's what I would do. I'd first of all ask them, to be fair to them, you know, you're claiming to be psychic. I don't know if you're right or wrong. I've got my suspicions, but I don't know yet. What do you claim to be able to do? Because I don't think all psychics claim they can do all things that are... paranormal or unusual.
I think if they did, then you know the government would be employing them to do something useful.
Indeed,
with them,
yes.
I suppose.
And the bookmakers wouldn't
absolutely
exist.
And there'd be no missing people. And why do psychics need emergency plumbers? But they seem to.
So let's talk about. Let's go back to that. A test. I mean, we've said you would ask the psychic, you know, what do they think they can do? What can they achieve? Under what conditions can they achieve that? And what results would they see as being a success?
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things would be? What sort of tests could we perform to actually?
There are literally innumerable numbers of tests. Any test where the five senses that we know about can't be employed is a sufficient test if they then get the answer to whatever it is. So the body in the boot test, the very first program, which was the sort of the warm-up program to get people to come and audition, in principle, that test is fine. It was just the execution of that test which was fundamentally flawed, in my view. The selection of the car should be entirely at random. Psychologically, the car should be placed in a way that there is no one car which is more dominant from a sort of Da Vinci eye looking at a painting point of view. Than any others. You don't want anybody in there, be it cameramen, presenters, anybody, knowing what the solution is, where the car is, because unwittingly we give things away. I've been on shoots where cameramen, who are operating on a battery, as the psychic approaches the target, be it a car or whatever else, put their lights on because they're conserving their battery. Now, they don't do that intentionally, but any sort of half-decent psychic is aware of these kind of things. I wouldn't have the same car used between tests, because if you've got two psychics coming in working together, the first one doesn't get it, finds out the answer, and then just dabs a bit of lipstick on the bumper. I'm not saying any of these things were happening, but importantly, I can't say that they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to be recognised for what they claim to be able to do, then they have to jump through the hoops that science at the moment has. They might not be the most sophisticated, it might not be the best way yet, but it is the only way, and every other thing that claims to have an impact on our knowledge of science has to jump through those hoops. Double-blind testing, peer-reviewed research, all these things are crucial. But it hasn't happened yet.
The other thing I was going to say was I was also struck by how pleased the sort of, you know, the psychics were when they got something right. It was like, I've done it. Surely you've got it right.
Absolutely. although I suppose you could argue that at the end of producing a fabulous painting, Da Vinci might have gone, yes. So I think we've got more powerful arguments against them than that. But I made the point with Dennis, who every time he got anything, which wasn't very often, he jumped for joy. And I was always, as you say, slightly intrigued that he was that surprised.
So let's talk about some more of the techniques. Can you? We mentioned cold reading and, mm-hmm. and hot reading before, but and you mentioned the idea that cold reading, there are things that you can say to people that, while seeming personal, are actually incredibly vague. So give us some examples of some of those.
Well, we all suffer with the same insecurities, sure. really. We hide them differently, but we all experience them. To give you specific lines, they never sound particularly edifying out of context. And a good cold reader will modify what they say. Not all cold sure. reading lines apply to all people. But we know that the majority of widowed women put their husbands watching, their dead husbands watching their bedside table. Mm. But when that psychic tells you, with the incumbent and crucial psychological need that goes with a visit to a medium, mm. then it feels very powerful. And we tend to cherry pick what we remember from a psychic consultation. So if I look at you, Neil, and say, I sense there's a female in your family who's involved with horses in some way, and I get an absolute blank from you, well, I'm not going to plough that furrow anymore, and I've always got the get out when you say, well, no, I can't think of anyone. Mm-hmm. Well, keep an eye on that, dear.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And that's not the bit you recount. If you are disposed towards the psychic and want to believe, and most of us do if we go and visit one, because we're not bad decision makers, are we? None of us. So to go in and not believe in your psychic, you have to accept, well, I made a bad decision. So we tend to come out feeling very positive about them. And the horse female thing that wasn't right doesn't get mentioned. But the fact that your front door is a sort of bluey green, and that's right, that does get mentioned. So we get this increasingly imbalanced body of evidence, because everybody coming out of their psychic consultation just adds to the pile of good stuff sure. and quietly forgets all the bad stuff.
So they can
stuff.
Give you 10 points and get 9 of them wrong, but it's yes. the one that they get right that you
Yes, and the one that's right also remarkable. Becomes the point that they yeah, press yeah. on.
Sure.
When they see that... I get a sense, Neil, that you're frustrated because you're in a relationship or have just come out of a relationship where you felt you were putting much more into it than your partner. Well, we all kind of feel that. But if there's a particular widening of the eyes when I say that, I know I'm into an area which mm-hmm. is worth exploring. There's a relationship going on here. And then inevitably, if you listen to tape recordings of these kind of sessions, although the sitter reports speaking very little, and I took all my rings off before I went in so they could get mm-hmm. no clues, and you get all of this stuff, when you listen back to the tape, the sitter is speaking on average 60 to 70% of the time, but their yeah. memory is that they spoke very little. But they've gone there with a need. So when they feel that the psychic has hit on that, you know, your relationship or whatever it may be, they get chatting. Because what they really want is just someone to tell them that it all feels better and to listen to them.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because
And on that level, sorry, one final thing. Yeah. On that level, they might be doing a useful service.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's very interesting because you basically describe the techniques that these people use. And also, you said, well, you use similar ones yourself in your work as the Grey Man. Mm. And yet the end results are completely different. Really.
I don't yeah. actually use similar results in similar techniques. I don't do a lot of cold reading when I'm working. It's much more neutral stuff that we're talking about. I might present you with 20 different colours and ask you to think of one and tell you which one you're thinking of. I don't tend to go into people's personal
right.
lives, which is where cold reading comes into its own, because in people's our personal lives, although very unique. The thing is, we're all unique, you know. and so that kind of stuff tends to work when you are talking about someone personally and specifically. What I do is very transient, very ethereal. I meet up with a group for 5 or 10 minutes, and it may be that we predict the numbers on a scratch card or a name of someone that they kissed, as I say, when they were young, or with their PIN number we might play around. But it's pretty neutral stuff. So I don't really do a lot of the stuff that we're talking about now, mm-hmm. because cold reading only really applies when...
In that context.
Yeah, in that context, which I don't do. I don't contact dead people.
No, thank goodness for that.
No.
I suppose what I was trying to get at, really, was do you sometimes feel...
I'm doing the same thing.
Just a kind of frustration that people aren't really going so much for the sort of thing that you do and seem to be flocking to see somebody tell you what their baby's thinking, you know.
Well, yeah, but then that's like asking a guy who sells sweets, does he get frustrated that he's not selling heroin? I mean, no. I'd be a lot richer if I was a psychic than if I was a sceptic.
Never been tempted?
No. No, because I like sleeping at night too much. In the States, I think I read recently, the figure is $6 billion a year spent on the psychic industry, which is exactly the same figure that they cite for all children's toys bought in America. So we spend as much on psychics as we do on much more tangible things. It's a huge, huge market, and I've not been tempted any more than I think you've been tempted to sell heroin. Not that I equate being a psychic, but for me, morally, the distinction is pretty similar.
Yeah.
Because I try and picture a scene where someone came to see me as a psychic, and I genuinely believe that because of my skills and techniques, I've left her or him feeling much better. I still have a problem with it, because I can't be sure that I'm not in some way stifling a more long-term but solid grieving process if it's about contacting a relative. We do know that people become addicted to going to see the psychic. Just one last contact with my son. And of course, the psychic's running out of ways of saying he loves you very much and he doesn't want you to worry about him and all these very comforting things. But they do keep going back. It becomes slightly addictive. And my problem would be, even if I was doing good in the first instance, am I stopping? I don't know enough about that to be sure that I'm not doing harm, and that's the reason why.
Yeah, again, going back to the interview on your website, you describe psychics and spiritualism as unavoidable in our culture. This is quite depressing, really, isn't it?
Well, then you're depressed at the limitations of human beings.
Sure.
And I can't do anything about that, because we are human. We're jealous, we're greedy, we're passionate, we're loving, we're care. We're all these things, and the more of one of those things you show someone as a child in the formative years, the more chance they'll have a lot of that left in their adult years. But if for whatever reason you haven't been given that, and you have been dealt some knocks, then you're more likely to develop these sides that do require... I just think it is inevitable, in the same way that aeroplanes are inevitable. Sure. We can't fly. Get over it.
Are you fascinated by what people... Oh, sorry, Ed, do you want to do
No,
that?
Please, go on.
I was going to say, are you fascinated by why people want to see psychics? And obviously there's a difference between, you know, people wanting to contact the dead and people just want to have their mind read or want to see somebody's reading somebody's...
Or to know what they're, you know, what whether they should apply for that job or what their future's going to hold in that sort of vague way.
Are you particularly fascinated by people's...
You've gone to the heart of it all, really. Yeah. It's not so much whether they do or don't go and see psychics, it's why. What is it about that dynamic that is making their life... Because as human beings, we move towards perceived comfort, and I don't mean comfort in terms of big fluffy pillows, I mean psychological comfort. We move towards perceived comfort, and we move away from perceived discomfort. We're sometimes wrong in what we're perceiving as comfortable and uncomfortable, but that's how we operate. Now, for some people, the belief in a god, the consultation with the psychic, gives a comfort. And I'm interested in what the route to that need is. Can we plot the human map? If we do that, and that, at that point in someone's life, will it inevitably lead to that? Obviously, there are so many thousands of variables every day in our lives that go towards making who we are. But yes, ultimately, understanding why we move in that direction and not in that direction, why we're motivated by that but not by that, why we're inhibited by that and not by that. That to me is fascinating, in the way that for some people looking under a bonnet is fascinating. That's my core interest.
Should we, Philip prepared during the break while the music was playing, Philip prepared another little test.
Just to fill you in, dear listener, I've got a bunch of business cards here, and during the break, I got Richard to write the letter S on the back of six of them, and you wrote the letter B on the back of six of them, and then you shuffled them up so that you two don't know what order they're in. So we've got a pile of 12 cards, some of which are Bs and some of which are Ss, and you guys don't know. That's what's important. I'm going to give you some and you some. Mm-hmm. I've given them roughly half each. And without looking at the other sides, this is what I want you to do. You're going to be the intuitive. You're going to be the mystics. I want you to hang on, go through them one at a time, just looking at the side you haven't written on, which is the same on every card. It's just my business card. And I want you to keep the ones that you feel drawn to, like that means so much to you two. And I want you to just drop into my hand the ones you don't want. I would suggest you keep at least two or three of them to make things interesting. So just go through them one at a time, keep the ones you feel drawn to, and give me back the ones you don't want. Just to recap, there's 12 cards. They've been shuffled thoroughly by Neil. I haven't touched them, so there's a mixture there, and these guys don't know what the order is. So skeptical as you are, let's see how marvellously intuitive you are. Richard's, I think, kept three, two or three, and
I've kept three.
You've kept three, I've kept four. For all the listeners, the ones you've given back, we've got a mixture of S's and B's, as you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing, if it's worked, is if you turn yours over first, Richard, and have a look at them one at a time, what have you got?
I've got three S's.
You've just kept cards with S on the back, because you were playing the skeptic. And if you turn yours over, Neil, you've just got four cards.
I've got four cards with B on
the back. Seemingly completely random, seemingly completely free of influence, and yet you played into my trap. Now, that timeshare we mentioned at the beginning, are you interested?
Absolutely. Well, that's quite an interesting point, isn't it? Because, you know, that was something that always... There was a trick that Darren Brown did where he managed to basically convert somebody to Christianity, I believe. He made them see God.
Messiah.
By touching them on the shoulder.
Yes, stimulating their pineal gland.
Which I thought was absolutely terrifying. If people can do that, they can change somebody's life forever.
Yes, I think, you know, Darren's show is an entertainment.
Yeah, so
and
maybe he was exaggerating.
Darren, I'm a huge fan of, and I think what he does is wonderful and intelligent and poignant, but don't believe everything you're told, and I think Darren would probably be the first to say that.
So there wasn't a scene afterwards where they had to go to this person and say, actually, God doesn't exist. I'm sorry about that.
what a crushing day that makes.
What a blow.
Absolutely. But yeah, we do know that a lot of the visions that visionaries in the past, who've been the foundation of some religions, we now know that there's a very strong link between apparitions and visions and epilepsy.
Mm.
And that we know that you can stimulate... They took Richard Dawkins, the great skeptic, and wonderful chap in my view, but they managed to sort of stimulate him to feeling he'd had some kind of experience. And this was with a big magnetic helmet that was stimulating the pineal gland. And we know that it's the activity in that area that can create these visions, these apparitions. And yet religions have been founded in what clearly were just the internal visions of people suffering with certain psychiatric disorders.
That's extraordinary.
Indeed. Well, I think on that note, profound
suitably
note,
mind-blowing.
We'll have to draw the show to a close. So, Philip, thanks very much.
Many thanks to you. Thank you, Neil. Thank you, Richard.
Letting us be your guinea pigs as well.
My
this
pleasure.
Afternoon.
Thank you for playing so well.
Can you tell us your website address?
Oh, no. www.thegreyman.com.
If anybody wants to look at that, it's a great little website.
No event too small.
And yes, he's available, weddings, parties, etc.
Thank you very much, guys. It's been enjoyable.
Sorry, our website is www.littleatoms.com.
Yeah, whatever.
And thanks to John Lovett for engineering splendidly for us this afternoon.
And in a few moments, Ed Pinsent will be winding up his sound projector. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Thank you.